Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Stephen Nadler. He is Vilas Research Professor, the William H. Hay Professor of Philosophy, and Affiliate Professor of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about his new book, The Portraitist, Franz Hals and His World. Stephen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the first things you bring up early on is this is not a sort of an art history. It's more of a biography.
Yeah, I don't pretend to be an art historian. It's not really my training, but I am fascinated both by the period and by art, especially the art of this period. And I also have a great deal of interest in writing lives. And because Franz Hals was an artist who's always fascinated me, I think he hasn't really gotten his due. And while everyone has heard of Rembrandt and Vermeer, often you come upon people who, while familiar with art, really don't know who Hals was or can't recall any of his paintings. So I thought, well, here's a really ripe project, bringing readers into the 17th century Dutch Golden Age, trying to illuminate a life that I think has really gone understudied, and recalling people to their attention to these magnificent portraits.
Now, I love the way that you got into doing Franz Hals' biography, because it starts with René Descartes.
Yeah, actually, it goes back even further than that. I mean, I was always, as somebody who works in the history of philosophy, I've always been studying the 17th century and writing about Descartes and his followers. But I really didn't get into 17th century Dutch culture until I started working on Spinoza. And so, some years ago, I wrote a biography of Spinoza, and I continue to study Spinoza and his philosophy, but also his life. And once Spinoza gets his hooks in you, that's it. You're done. You're committed for the rest of your life. And so when studying Spinoza, you can't help but look more deeply into the culture in which he lived. He was born and raised in Amsterdam into a family of Portuguese Jews. So you start to study the history, the religion, the politics of the period. And then you start to notice that there are all these incredible paintings of Jews and Jewish themes by Dutch artists. So that led me to write a book called Rembrandt's Jews, which came out in 2003. Then, bitten by the art historical bug, I decided to look more closely at the way in which philosophers were represented by 17th century Dutch artists, which led me to write a book about a portrait of Descartes that was painted by Franz Hals, and to put that in the context of Descartes' life. And then I thought, well, I really could do something interesting with Hals himself, and that finally led to this book.
For a biographer, Hals seems to be a bit of a challenge, because there's a lot of blank spots. There's a lot of things we don't know about his life.
Yeah, it's true. And the biographies I've written of 17th century figures, so there's Spinoza, there's Rabbi Manasseh ben Israel, who I wrote a biography of a few years ago. I really love the challenge of trying to recreate a life with minimal materials. I think I would feel really daunted were I to try to write a biography of somebody from whom we have thousands of letters and innumerable testimonials and so on. Whereas with these individuals, especially Spinoza, we have his philosophical writings and we have his correspondence, but we really do not have a lot of biographical materials about him, especially his early life. Manasseh ben Israel as well, we have some letters, but again, not a lot of authentic documentation. And with Hals, it's really a challenge to create a kind of silhouette of the person. So if you can describe enough around them, you get a fairly clear sense of who they were and what mattered to them and how they lived their lives.
Let's start out with a couple of general things about Hals. You call him brilliant but irascible. I love that. That's what I want to be.
I love the brilliant part.
If you're going to be brilliant, you might as well be irascible.
You do. You want a reputation for being kind. You want to be irascible, but you don't want people to think you're irascible. Well, unless you don't want people approaching you. In that case, yeah, be as irascible as you want.
And it's amazing. And I had been familiar with Francois' work for decades before this, but how controversial his style is. His approach to his sitters was definitely his own. It's something that he developed himself. And it's amazing when you really look at the brushstrokes, for instance. They're full of energy and immediacy. It's very different from those set of flat paintings that you see from Holland at the same time.
Yeah, he was strikingly original in that way. And, you know, it's you might find some precedent for that kind of rough brushwork in some Flemish art from the period, especially some painters working in Rubens' workshop in Antwerp. But he really took it in his own direction. And, you know, these days we think of Rembrandt as the master of rough painting, but Hals was doing it decades before Rembrandt.
Yep, yep.
And we have very good reason for thinking that the two painters were together in Amsterdam at around the same time, working in the same studio and in the early 1630s. And so it's not implausible to think that Rembrandt was looking at what Hals was doing on his panels and canvases and thinking, huh, that's an interesting way to go about this. So I think we should give Hals his due credit for developing this style, this kind of rough style. And it did become popular for a time, even when high society patrons were looking for something a little finer, a little more finished. It still remained a very popular way of painting.
It's fascinating to me that people at that time, contemporary people, either think his style was very fresh and cutting edge, or there were people who said that it was unfinished and sloppy.
Yeah, but that's the way taste goes, isn't it?
Yeah.
everybody, you know, there's always somebody who loves something and there's always somebody who hates it. And, you know, even Rembrandt had his harsh critics. One critic said that the paint drips down Rembrandt's canvases like dreck. That would be the Dutch word, and I don't think on public radio I can use
the
proper translation of that. So even, you know, even the great Rembrandt had a mixed reputation at his time, but nonetheless became perhaps the most popular painter among his contemporaries as well.
And it's amazing when you look at the attitude of the people in his portraits too. As you mentioned, the people are fully present. They're often looking at the viewer. They're in a variety of ways that they're sitting. There's a lot of activity going on, or at least, and I think at one point in your book you said there are more smiles and laughter represented in his work than anybody else in Western art.
Yeah, it's a lot of joy coming through these paintings. There's also a lot of dignity. Is even a lot of love. I think his ability to capture in marriage pendants, that is these dual portraits of a man and a woman celebrating their marriage, there are a couple where you see these two individuals looking across the space.
Yeah.
You know, there's a separate portraits looking across at each other, and you really get a sense that there's a great deal of affection here. So I think as wonderful as Rembrandt is in capturing the inner life, I think it's overused, but, you know, capturing something about the sitter, their emotional state, I think Hals himself was a master at that. And you really do feel like you're in the presence of a living person experiencing all sorts of passions.
Hals was born in Antwerp, but really very much was of Harlem. Why did he move to Harlem?
The family moved in the 1580s, along with a lot of other families, especially textile workers, but also artists and art dealers, because the southern provinces of the Netherlands, all of the Dutch provinces had belonged to Spain. They were part of the Habsburg Empire. And then when the Dutch revolted from Spain, they were becoming a much more Protestant area, and Catholic Spain was not really very tolerant of these Protestant lands, the Dutch revolted, and that was the beginning of 80 years of war. And in 1584, 1585, Spain reconquered quite a few of the southern Dutch provinces, including Flanders, And a lot of the families, mostly Protestant families, left for the northern provinces, Holland, Utrecht, Zeeland, and the others, because there they would feel somewhat safer among other Protestants. But also a lot of Catholic families left as well, because in the midst of the war, the Dutch managed to cut off access to Antwerp, which was an incredibly wealthy port city. But once the Dutch captured the mouth of the Scheldt River and access to the North Sea, the economic fortunes of Antwerp really started to decline. And so a lot of businesses, not just for religious reasons, but for economic reasons, headed north because they saw that that's where their future was. And Hollis's family was one of these. His father was a textile worker. And so with this massive emigration from Flanders to the north, the family went along, and that's where they settled.
It's one of the brilliant things of your book that you do a really good job of setting the context for Frans Hals and Harlem. You know, looking at a lot of Dutch paintings, people may think it was a sort of a serene time. You know, we talk about the sort of golden age, the Dutch golden age. But as you clearly point out, you know, it was a time of almost constant warfare. And if that wasn't enough, there was all this political conflict, there was religious strife, and then there was problems with forces of nature, like the Little Ice Age. A lot was going on in that section, that part of the world at that time.
There was. You know, we like to look at these lovely, quiet interiors painted by Vermeer, or the great landscapes by Ruysdael, and think, oh, how I would love to be walking through that calm wooded pathway with a little Dutch village in the distance. But it was rough. And as I say in the book, the golden age, Dutch golden age, was not golden for everybody. The Dutch were deeply involved in the capture and trade of enslaved people, even though slavery itself was not permitted in Holland itself. They were shipping slaves from Africa to their colonies in Brazil, in the Caribbean, and in East Asia. And then you have extraordinarily harsh religious strife. Even within the Protestant camp, you had conservative Calvinists.
Oh, my God. There's this whole thing with the Remonstrance and the Counter-Remonstrance.
Yeah, it was ugly. And, you know, it was almost the way in which American politics works today. Things are flying back and forth from one extreme to the other. And you never know from year to year whether your camp is going to be on the outs or not. And if you were in, for example, in the Remonstrant group, the more liberal Calvinist camp, and then the counter-Remonstrants happen to take over the leadership of your city, you might find yourself out of a job, especially if you're one of the civic authorities.
Well, let's talk about Harlem for a bit. The important industries were linen, but also beer. I was amazed at how many breweries there were in Harlem at that time.
Yeah, beer was crucial to the economy of several Dutch cities, but especially Harlem. Partly it was a matter of, again, these Flemish brewers heading north to reestablish their businesses. But also beer was a major beverage, not just among college students, but because the water in the Netherlands was not always safe to drink. And so there were different degrees of alcoholic beer. So even children were often given very diluted beer to drink, because once the water goes through the brewing process, it's somewhat safer to drink. And the most important well-connected and wealthy families of Harlem tended to be these brewer families, many of whom went to Hals for their portraits.
It's amazing. Harlem was also famous for art. And lots of these emigre artists from the southern Netherlands emigrated to Harlem. The Art Guild, how did they deal with the fact that there was this tremendous influx of artists?
It was not a very easy process of acceptance. I mean, the native Harlem artists were very jealous of their prerogatives, and they were not willing to just open up the art market to these newcomers. But at the same time, a lot of Harlem art, I think, prospered through the what was being brought to them from these Flemish centers of art. And so they're each, I think it's safe to say that for various Dutch cities, there's a kind of artistic tradition. So the Utrecht had its tradition of Caravaggists, artists who had studied or been influenced by Italian artists, especially Caravaggio. In Leiden, you had the Feinschilders, the fine art painters, very meticulous and detailed and nicely finished paintings. And Haarlem had a very long tradition going back to the early 16th century of portraiture, especially group portraiture, and also religious art. And I think despite the difficulty in the Flemish immigrants becoming accepted within the Dutch guild, eventually they became ruler, you know, real leaders of the Haarlem art scene, and I think contributed to its popularity.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Stephen Nadler. He is Vilas Research Professor, the William H. Hay Professor of Philosophy, an affiliate professor of art history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about his new book, The Portraitist, Frans Hals and His World. Let's talk about the Art Guild. Now, you had to join the Art Guild if you wanted to market your paintings, right?
Yes, you did. The Guild managed both the training of artists, so apprenticeships and assistantships. It managed the sale of art, where you could sell it, how you could market it, and even it managed contractual agreements between patrons and artists, and especially dealing with disputes.
What was a master painter?
A master painter was an individual who had gone through the proper training, at least 3 years as an apprentice to a master, and then a couple of years as a journeyman, that is, still working perhaps with a master or on their own. And then finally, once you have, in a sense, graduated from this probationary period, you were a master painter and authorized to establish your own workshop and have your own apprentices and assistants.
And I think people need to understand what the art market was like in the Dutch Republic, because it was not like it was other places. There was no royal patronage. People, everyday people, were getting paintings done and hanging them in their house. They were hanging them everywhere.
Yeah, I think, and not just no royal patronage, because this was a Calvinist nation, and I'll use the word nation there, even though it wasn't until 1648 that it formally arrived at its independence from Spain. Because it was Calvinist, and the Calvinists did not approve of hanging images in churches, you did not have really much ecclesiastic patronage. So whereas, let's say, in France or Italy, a good deal of the patronage came from the church, from in Rome, famously, from the Pope and the cardinals and the families governing various Italian cities like Florence, Mantua, and Venice in the Republic there. In the Netherlands, there was no major church patronage. And as you mentioned, there was no royalty. This was a republic. And the aristocracy was kind of thinned out. So most of the art, and we're talking about a tremendous number of paintings, millions of works of art being produced in the 17th century. It was sold in various ways. If you were wealthy enough, and let's say a well-off brewer in Haarlem, you could commission portraits from the artist directly. You can go to the studio and sit for your portrait, or have your family sit for the portrait. But there were many other ways to acquire paintings. You could go to art dealers, and there are quite a few of these, many of whom were also emigres from Flanders. You could buy paintings at auctions, either estate auctions or auctions that were being held in the service of charity. There were also lotteries and art fairs. There are probably, I'm going to guess that in the Netherlands, there are more ways of acquiring paintings, all sorts, all across the economic scale, than in any other country in Europe at the time.
Wow. Now, Hubble,
and there were paintings everywhere. There were paintings in houses. There were paintings.
And that doesn't sound odd today, but it was very odd back then.
Yeah, it was, well, mainly because it was so expensive.
Yeah.
You know, elsewhere, who could afford a portrait or painting? But in the Netherlands, in the Dutch Republic especially, even if you weren't wealthy, you could buy a little picture and hang it in your kitchen.
Excellent.
Or, you know, we know that there were paintings hanging in the guild halls, in the corporation headquarters, in the civil, the military guilds. They commissioned paintings of themselves to celebrate their service. Taverns had paintings. We know that even that brothels had paintings, usually paintings of the women who were the sex workers in these institutions.
Now, Hals was a home buddy. Once he got to Harlem, he didn't really travel very much.
No, we know of two trips that he took to Antwerp, possibly on family business. We're not quite sure what the reasons were. And these were, I think, very useful trips for him to make in terms of the development of his art. But no, he never traveled to Italy or France. Probably, as far as we know, with the exception of the trips to Antwerp, he never left Holland. And seems rarely to have left Harlem itself. There is the instance of the commission that came his way from Amsterdam when one of the civic guards there asked him to paint their portrait. It didn't go well because he dragged things out. Things weren't, he wasn't finishing the painting, and this over the course of several years, the lieutenant and the captains of the guard were getting impatient. And he really didn't want to spend a lot of time in Amsterdam doing this painting. So there was disagreement about what was the contract about? Was he supposed to be in Amsterdam? And he ended up not finishing the painting, and they eventually went to another painter, a local Amsterdam artist, to finish it for them.
Well, just for a moment, let's talk about the civic guards in Harlem, because he did these amazing portraits of these civic guards that were just incredible. Who were they?
They were civilian militias, in a sense. And what that means by what I mean by civilian is that they were ordinary citizens. They weren't professional soldiers. In fact, they had to pay to do their duty. But it was considered an honor to serve in one of the civic guards. It was a 2 or 3 year term. And you had to buy your own equipment. And essentially, it was like a fraternity. And even though early on they did do some military service and were occasionally called upon to stand guard and take the place of professional soldiers when those soldiers had to go actually fight somewhere, eventually they were more like social clubs. And it was considered part of your duty as a leading citizen of the city to do your time in a guard, and also a great honor.
And they would commission these group portraits. And it's amazing to look at Frans Hals's portraits of these and compare them to ones that were done by other artists of the period or earlier. His ones really make it look like you're there among the partiers.
Yeah, they're beautiful. The way in which there's depth, there's activity in the painting. They're very recognizable faces. So these are real portraits.
Yeah.
And the way they're interacting with each other, it's like a party in some of the instances. They're celebrating at a banquet to commemorate the end of their service. And a couple of, often some of the individuals are looking out at us, but others are reaching for food or drinking or chatting with their neighbor in the painting. And if you go to the Frans Hals Museum in Harlem, which I recommend you do, it's a great, wonderful museum. There are six of these. They're huge paintings because the figures are painted life-size. They have six of them in one room, and you can almost hear the noise of the celebrations in the paintings.
So many of we only have a few minutes left, but so many of his works are just so joyous, too. You look at a painting like the Rommel Pot Player, or Jonker Romp and His Sweetheart. There's so much liveliness in these works. They're incredible.
They are, and I think he was especially a master of painting children. when children are sometimes portrayed in early modern art, they look like tiny little adults. But somehow House was just fantastic at capturing that child, that child's face, the joy or the disappointment or the surprise. These little, what they're called tronies, these little head studies of boys and girls blowing bubbles or drinking something or playing with an instrument or holding a cat. They're just so charming and I think really capture something essential about the innocence of childhood.
The amazing thing is Halls quickly became the portraitist of choice for Harlem's elite. Yet, he seems to have had financial problems his entire life.
Yeah, we really don't know what the problem was. There has grown up this myth about Halls drinking all his profits. There's really no hard evidence that he wasted all his time and money in the taverns. Perhaps it was true, perhaps not. But he really did seem to have trouble keeping up with his creditors. But he did have a large family, and it was an expensive family. He had one son who was suffering from mental illness and had to be kept in cities' institutions, and that would have cost him. He was also at times bailing other of his adult children out of trouble. It was just, a matter of being overwhelmed by the expenses. And portraiture was not the most remunerative genre of painting. He wasn't doing large biblical or history paintings. Those brought in the most money. And so he was always in arrears.
With that, we're going to unfortunately have to sign off. We could be talking about this book for hours. My guest tonight is Stephen Nadler. He is the Villis Research Professor, the William H. Hay Professor of Philosophy, and Affiliate Professor of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we've been talking about his book. It is a wonderful read, The Portraitist, Franz Hall and His World. Stephen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.